Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine two major stories in the news. Starting with foreign policy, we'll look at Syria on the brink, following Secretary of State Clinton's warning to the Russians that unless they get serious about restraining the Assad killing machine, Russia will be responsible for Syria plunging into civil war. Aram Nagizian, a visiting fellow in strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, joins us to discuss reports that recently French President Sarkozy and Saudi Defense Minister Prince Salman were ready to bomb the Assad clan's palace on top of Mount Kisun, but the joint French-Saudi airstrike was vetoed by President Obama. Then we'll switch to domestic politics and discuss our dysfunctional Congress with two veteran Washington insiders, Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann. Together, they have written a provocative bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Both longtime observers and noted scholars of Congress, they have been effectively banned by the mainstream media because they break the sacred convention of phony balance by pointing out that the Republicans are largely to blame and that the Democrats can no longer be described as the liberal party and the Republicans as the conservative party. Now the Democrats are the conservative party and the Republicans are the radical party. And joining us now is Aram Nagizian, who is a visiting fellow with the Ali A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he specializes in security, politics, and military development in the Middle East, focusing on the Lebanese military, U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, and challenges to civil-military relations in post-conflict and divided societies. Aram Nagizian has authored or co-authored a number of reports at CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risk of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, the Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and his books include Israel and Syria, The Military Balance and the Prospects of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aram Nagizian.
Happy to be back.
And there's Secretary of State Clinton speaking to some students in Copenhagen, basically chastised the Russians today, suggesting that they were the only ones that could alter the situation in Syria, and that if they didn't do so, I'm paraphrasing, the situation will lead to a civil war. In other words, the Russians are going to be responsible for a civil war. Is that likely to get Putin's attention?
Well, I mean, it certainly grabs headlines, and it goes a bit further than expelling what little diplomatic presence the Syrians have remaining in the United States and Europe. But the reality is that it's a two-sided coin. There needs to be more pressure from the Russians, from the Chinese, towards some kind of a settlement of what is increasingly looking like a civil violence pattern that has gone completely off the rails. On the other side of the equation, you have to have countries that are supporting the militarization of the opposition, who also take stock and ask themselves, you know, what are the real long-term consequences of either staying on this course or not factoring in the real risks to neighboring states around Syria, such as Lebanon or Jordan, and even countries like Israel, Iraq, and Turkey, all of which are likely to become unstable if you have a protracted cycle of violence within Syria. So yes, there needs to be more action on the part of the Russians, who are the only actors right now, short of Iran, that have any real access to the Assad regime, a role that Turkey used to enjoy but has, unfortunately, no longer has that kind of influence right now. Beyond that, the Gulf states, too, have to also accept that while the tactical gains of Assad no longer being in power are very palatable for all the right reasons, there needs to be a strategic view about what's happening in the broader region in the context of sectarian violence and potentially years, if not decades, of civil war.
So there's a report out, Aram, that just before he was essentially kicked out by the French voters, Nicolas Sarkozy and Saudi Defense Minister Prince Salman, who arrived in the White House on April the 12th, where he made a personal presentation, and apparently Sarkozy was also phoning the president all the way up until he lost the recent election to try and persuade President Obama to allow the French to attack the mountaintop palace in Mount Kisun of the Assad clan, with French warplanes taking off from the carrier Charles de Gaulle, and Saudi and the United Arab Emirates bombers flying through Jordan. This plan apparently was, if it's true or not, was vetoed by President Obama. Does that strike you as probable?
Well, if you had this sort of discussion, the one thing I certainly can say, although I can't comment on the validity, I can say that I would not be surprised if you did have a strong rebuke from the United States on such an approach. And there are a number of reasons for that. The first is that, frankly, regional states such as Jordan have deep reservations about their own role, their own place within a deepening cycle of violence within Syria, and stand to really suffer from side effects of spillover effects from Syria. Beyond that, the U.S. has really taken a very long look at Syria. And unlike countries like Saudi Arabia and maybe up to a point France, the U.S. values the strategic picture in Syria far more than the tactical. The same cannot be said of Saudi, which so far seems to value tactical gains and feels very comfortable that it can secure or help secure a stable strategic future for Syria. What that means, in essence, is the U.S. is very reluctant, bearing all the lessons it's learned over time, in some cases is only now integrating those lessons, from the Iraqi experience, let alone the experience in Lebanon in the early 80s, that really getting into these kinds of divided societies through military intervention, while it does hark back to the days of Srebrenica, this is anything but a European environment. This is a Levantine tinderbox where underlying sectarian pressures are not going to be resolved or satisfied by a couple of airstrikes. And those, if there were airstrikes against targets that are sensitive to the Assad family and the immediate ruling elite, it doesn't change the fact that you have a much broader web of interests tied to the Alawite sect, tied to other Christian interest groups, and also other small heterodox communities, Ismailis, and of course the Kurds, all of which, frankly, even under the most heinous of circumstances linked to violence by the Assad regime, don't really seem to have a clear path or set of alternatives, either in a post-Assad context or one where you have dramatic political change. And the U.S. is very wary of this. And this is one of the reasons why there has been a very strong reluctance in all the branches of government in the United States to really think of military action as anything but the last option on the list.
Again, I'm speaking with Aram Nagizian, who's a visiting fellow with the Ali A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he's authored a number of reports, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risks of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, The Proxy Cold War in the Levant. So given that the Annan plan, which was largely put together by the Russians, and clearly going back, the Russians and the Chinese vetoed any UN Security Council resolutions that might lead to any stronger intervention short of the sanctions that have been imposed. Clearly, what's just happened in Hula and is continuing to happen, it's actually been happening all along. You can even go back to the days of Bashar Assad's father killing, 30,000 people in Hama. What's the Russian end game here? I mean, wouldn't it make sense for them to want to make some kind of a deal? Because this situation is going to get worse, isn't it? And won't eventually, the U.S. keeps saying that Assad will eventually go. I don't know what they're basing that on. But I think just looking as objectively as you can, I would think for this regime, the days are numbered.
Well, there are three real victims in Syria. One is, of course, the Syrian people. No matter who wins, who's in charge, we're looking at a country that is looking at a minimum, a decade of uncertainty and instability. So one has to take stock of that. But beyond that, the two other real failures in the Syria crisis are failure to assess what diplomacy really should look like in order to resolve this kind of crisis. And that is one of the biggest failings vis-a-vis not only the Russians, the countries that are supporting Assad, but also on the part of the West and the U.S. We don't live in a world that is so different from during the Cold War period or even in the post-9/11 period that something as simple as national security imperatives cannot be a significant obstacle to creating international momentum. The United States and other actors for months have downplayed just how important and how central these national security considerations might be for Russia, tied to having access to the Mediterranean, tied to not having a repeat of the kinds of foreign policy and geostrategic losses incurred when you had Libya essentially spiral down this path whereby at the end of the day, from a Russian point of view, Libya is essentially no longer a critical component of Russia's foreign policy in North Africa and the Mediterranean. So you do have these concerns. And frankly, you know, the U.S., if they really want Russia to play a positive role, given that Turkey has essentially ejected itself as a potential honest broker, the U.S. and the international community are stuck with a Russia that, frankly, can continue to apply leverage. In some cases, I could even go so far as to say that they have more influence on how this maps out than the Iranians do. But this all also falls on a very stark reality, which is that even though we live in a 24-hour news cycle and this sort of violence is reprehensible, it doesn't change the fact that all of this is happening in a geopolitical context tied to regional competition between the Gulf states and Iran, the debate about Iran's nuclear program, the fact that Syria sits on a very precarious Sunni-Shiite fault line. And then there's, of course, the last fatality or casualty of the Syria crisis, which is any semblance of truth, whether it is in measuring the true scale of repression by Assad or the reality that, frankly, the opposition is far more divided, far more complex, and far less certain as a future structure than any of us would really like to admit. All of these things make it very difficult to chart the path. And while it is hopeful to think that Assad will leave, you know, at some point in the short term, or that he's doomed no matter what, the reality is that the kind of support his regime has from the Alawite sect and from other communities that rely on this minority political system are such that Assad and his security apparatus and interest groups could very well survive the collapse of Syria. That's how sectarian this has all become. And I would not be surprised that if there is a real loss of control by the regime on Syria, they would revert to some very primal views about what their interests are, tied to communal autonomy, protecting their ancestral villages. And that's an even darker chapter, where you will see ethnic cleansing and counter-ethnic cleansing in a cycle of violence that will look nothing like a lot of this talk of the Yemeni model, and far more like the Algerian example, which is to say a belligerent and very stubborn regime that will just keep at it, hitting at the opposition until, frankly, nothing looks even remotely civil anymore, and you have 10 years of violence with no clear sense of what comes out at the end of the tunnel. So all of these things are happening. It's wishful thinking to think that this will be resolved quickly. But if there's going to be a settlement of any way, shape, or form, it is intrinsically tied to the discussions on Iran. It is intrinsically tied to the regional balance of power in the Gulf. And it does tie in very heavily on the Sunni-Shiite fault lines in the region. And without addressing those points, it's going to be all but impossible to settle the crisis in Syria. And even then, it might be far too difficult given the amount of pressure there is internally between the different communities.
So, Aram Nagezian, it's beginning to sound, though, that Secretary of State's actually correct in suggesting if the Russians hold all the cards, that if they don't play these cards now, the situation is going to spin out of control. And even though there's a tremendous asymmetry in military power, apparently arms are starting to trickle into the rebels, so that'll just increase. And you've also mentioned the kind of Gotterdammerung scenario, and I believe that the Alawites are fortifying a lot of the mountains in the northwest. So all of those things are true. So what could be done to at least arrive at some kind of modus vivendi between the factions before a full-scale bloody civil war breaks out?
Again, as I mentioned earlier, the reality is that the Russians need to do more, but you know, you have to remember how the Annan plan kicked off. It kicked off in parallel to meetings supporting the opposition that pledged $100 million, if not more, to finance the insurrection within Syria. So realistically, you have an Assad regime that doesn't really want peace on anything but its own terms. And you also want to have the kind of environment whereby you control how the outcome evolves. Beyond that, you have an opposition that also has been anything but committed to a lasting pattern for peace. So you do have to have not just the Russians, but also the Gulf states really sign off on this idea that peace is better than a protracted cycle of violence. And if we do get there, the way you do whittle this down and the way you do move this along is probably not by ignoring the sectarian cleavages within the country. The Assad regime continues to behave as if the religion of Syria is being Syrian and that the Syrian Ba'athi narrative still holds any water. But the problem is that it's not just the Assad period that is coming under attack and being delegitimized. The entire post-colonial Syrian experiment since 1946 is slowly whittling away, and there are real risks that you can't put the genie back in the bottle. In that kind of a scenario, again, as I mentioned before, the worst case is a protracted cycle of violence, like the Algerian civil conflict. But the other model, which is not much better, but holds at least some promise of short-term stability, is to institutionalize sectarian politics in a loose confederal system. And for that to happen, there needs to be acceptance by the players in the country that protecting minority interests, let alone the interests of the majority, matter a great deal. And it'll need strong internal support and external support. It's not a good option. Repeating the experience of that Iraq is going through now, or the one that Lebanon went through over the course of its post-independence period, are anything but examples of successful transitions to stability. But the alternative is essentially a decade or two-decade-long cycle of violence. So one should really consider, if this is what's going to stop the cycle, it might as well be considered. And it does tie in, of course, to the broader regional balance of power.
So, Aram Dagizian, you mentioned the Algerian example as a portent of how bad things could get. In many ways, though, isn't there a kind of post-colonial chickens coming home to roost here in the way that they did in Rwanda, where the French, as did the British, always put a minority tribe in charge, and now the majority is basically no longer wants to abide by those rules?
Well, that is certainly true. I mean, you did have over-recruiting of Alawites within the security apparatus, and the French, as were the British, were very capable at divide-and-rule strategies in the Levant. And so you did have the emergence, even in 1955, of a heavily Alawite NCO corps and officer corps within the post-colonial Syrian military. But realistically, that's a problem that is going to be there. What is much more challenging is, even if you change that, even if you reverse the power distribution, you have to look at other aspects of Syria's post-colonial legacy. From 1946 to 1969, Syria was a banana republic of coups and counter-coups. And after that, you had the Ba'ath period. When you remove the Assad regime, you have to do it knowing that you're not only removing 30 to 40 years of Ba'athi rule, you're also stripping away the myth that a foundation exists underneath all of this that can support a meaningful and viable transition to a civil state in Syria. And the reality is that that does not exist. You can't rapidly accelerate the development of these founding institutions. They either emerge through a long-term cycle of trial and error, through violence, or through the transferring of these sorts of approaches in ways that are much more manageable. For example, the transfer of best practices from the United Kingdom over to the colonies in the United States and the foundations there that led to the United States that we know. So all of these things don't exist there. So you're looking at a Syria that is going to be very unstable, regardless of who's in charge, and that is in part because of the kinds of over-recruiting that the 1920s, 30s, and 40s saw in terms of Alawites, but also because of the underlying structural challenges which existed even before the Alawites came to true predominance in the political system.
So just in closing then, Aram Nagezian, I understand the intelligence reports indicate that there are about 26 sites for weapons of mass destruction. The Syrians have, military have a fairly mature arsenal, I believe, of chemical and possibly biological weapons. Obviously, there was that attempt to work with the North Koreans that the Israelis preempted in terms of nuclear. But if you end up with a kind of Somalia on the Mediterranean, if things go as dire as you've laid out earlier, what could be done to secure those arsenals?
Well, first I should mention that realistically it's not so much as Somalia on the Mediterranean. The worst-case scenario, if the Alawites do lose control, central control over Syria, is that they'll revert back. As you mentioned, there's a lot of fortification in their ancestral villages. It is a precursor to rolling back and to consolidating autonomous space within the Mediterranean coastline, the traditional Nuseri Mountain. And frankly, Kosovo and South Sudan have set the kinds of precedents that minority groups that feel that they have to secure autonomy can say, hey, look, this exists, we're going to try and do the same thing. Now, to come back to the point of the country's WMD holdings, you have anywhere between 25 and 50 chemical and biological weapons holding facilities in Syria. And they do present, along with Syria's very large holdings of man-portable air defense systems, a significant proliferation risk. And this is really the other side of the coin in terms of why the U.S. is so reluctant to escalate things in Syria. Because if you do have even limited safeguards now, they pale in comparison to the kinds of safeguards Libya had under Muammar Gaddafi. Post-2004, there was an emphasis on bringing a lot of these stockpiles under better control, under international safeguards. You have none of those safeguards with regards to Syria. And the fact that you have fighters trickling into Syria from Lebanon, the fact that you have fighters trickling from other neighboring states as well, like Jordan, but mainly from Iraq, all of these things make it very complicated to really map out if there are risk factors that could lead to true proliferation and the kinds of acquisition that, frankly, many in the U.S. are terrified to imagine. Jihadi groups or groups with more militant politics than even some of the more metastasized opposition forces in Syria. So these are the kinds of long-term concerns the U.S. has, because countries like Libya that have gone through patterns of instability, foreign intervention, and boots on the ground to secure these facilities, you still had some proliferation in the low thousands of manned portable air defense missiles. Now, in a country like Syria, you have much larger holdings, and you also have large holdings of surface-to-air missiles, to say nothing of anti-tank guided missiles and ship-mounted and ground-mounted anti-ship cruise missiles. All of these things, all of these high-ticket items in terms of military capability, these are all things that fall under scrutiny when you have to think about intervention. So these are the things that a lot of folks in the U.S., especially in the Pentagon, have to keep thinking about.
Well, Aram Nagezian, I thank you so much for giving us this briefing today on what's happening in Syria and what could happen.
It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Aram Nagezian, who's a visiting fellow at the Ali A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he specializes in security, politics, and military development in the Middle East, focusing on the Lebanese military, U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, and challenges to civil-military relations in post-conflict and divided societies. He has authored and co-authored a number of reports at CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risks of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, The Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and his books include Israel and Syria, The Military Balance and the Prospects of War.
Now there's a woman on my block, just sits there, facing the hill, saying, who's gonna take away, who's gonna take away? Who's gonna take away? Who's gonna take away? His life is secure. Now he's hell-bent for destruction.
Watching the horse as it follows the cart, I sweep off my broken spell, and I felt something change in the world. Like a new cause. pursue at all times, at all costs, the truth.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with two veteran Washington observers, co-authors of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, who's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an election eve analyst for CBS News. His books include The Permanent Campaign and Its Future, The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track with Thomas Mann, and most recently, the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, which is co-authored by Thomas Mann, who is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, where he holds the W. Averill Harriman Chair. A noted congressional scholar, Thomas Mann writes and speaks widely on American politics and policymaking, including campaigns, elections, campaign finance, reform, and the effectiveness of the Congress. His most recent books, co-authored again with Norman Ornstein, is It's Far Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be with you.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
And let me start with Norman. I recently hosted Buddy Romer and Rocky Anderson and a representative of Americans Elect to kind of explore the possibilities of third parties. And, of course, Buddy Romer just quit today. So when you're talking about American politics becoming polarized, which you do in your book, I was always led to believe that America is a centrist country, that politicians on the left and the right, they hug the left and the right in the primaries, but move back to the center for the general. And that's where the kind of fulcrum, the center of gravity is in American politics. Yet nobody in the center can get arrested, right?
Well, I think, you know, there were many flaws in the Americans Elect approach. And in our book, Tom and I were pretty critical of them and the whole notion of a third party coming to the rescue. But a good part of the reason is that the theory here is that both parties have moved to the extremes, so there's this vast opening in the middle, when the reality is that one party has moved to the extreme and the other is occupying the center or center left. When you look at some of the people who have supported ardently the notion of a third party, like columnist Matt Miller with Roots in Los Angeles, it's basically a plea for a set of policies that are very similar to those that Barack Obama has pushed. And the idea that you could bring in a third party who might then contribute to electing an extremist in a three-way race, or at least damage the legitimacy of a winner, just doesn't make a lot of sense.
So are you're suggesting then we have a centrist candidate, and that is President Obama.
Yeah, if you look at the health care bill that passed, it was basically the moderate Republican alternative from the early 1990s, melded with the Romney plan. You look at the budget plans that Obama has endorsed, including the Gang of Six plan in the Senate. They're centrist. There's no public option in the health care plan. I mean, the idea that this is a set of left-wing policies just is not true.
Again, I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, who writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an election eve analyst for CBS News, and Thomas Mann, who's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, where he holds the W. Averill Harriman Chair. They're co-authors of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. So, Thomas Mann, tell us about the concept that's in your book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks. In other words, you're saying that both parties participate in tribal warfare, but both are not equally culpable, and that what we have now is asymmetrical polarization?
Yeah, it's so common for analysts, for reporters, for nonpartisan groups to say, well, the problem is the polarization of the parties. They've moved to extreme positions, and if we can just bring them both back toward the center to find a sort of golden mean between them, then we can take the steps necessary to deal with the serious problems confronting the country. The difficulty with that is it isn't true. There's just overwhelming evidence that the Republicans have really careened off the tracks, moved far to the right, embraced what by conventional standards would be considered radical changes in policy, and have embraced a kind of strategic view of competition with the other side that leads them to, for example, take the debt ceiling crisis or pseudo crisis, put the full faith and credit of the United States at risk, to hold it hostage to achieve specific policy objectives. So it's both a sort of ideological movement to the right, but just as important, it's a strategic calculation about how their interests are best served. That means all-out opposition, no compromise, no negotiation. If they fail to use the filibuster to say to kill legislation, then anything they can do to discredit it or nullify it by filibustering appointees to serve in the agencies created by the law. So it's an all-out effort to take down the other side. Democrats are not angels, mind you. They're subject to the same incentives, but basically they believe in government, and they're not prepared to take it down or take down the economy. If you just look at the reaction of Democrats after George W. Bush was elected under very controversial circumstances in 2000, and compare that with Obama's decisive victory in 2008 and the reaction of the Republicans to his presidency, you see the difference. Yes, Democrats opposed, but they also came together on No Child Left Behind. Some of their members joined the president in supporting tax cuts for good or for evil. Many supported the decision to go to war in Iraq. But carry forward to the period of Barack Obama, and you will see explicitly they announced their strategy to engage in no dealings with this president. They needed to defeat him. That means to deny him success with the policies that might actually serve his political purpose, but which might also help the country.
Again, I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, who writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an election eve analyst for CBS News, and Thomas Mann, a noted congressional scholar who writes and speaks widely on American politics and policymaking, including campaigns, elections, campaign finance reform, and the effectiveness of Congress. Together, they've written this new book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. But just, Norman, just following on what Thomas was just saying, your book, which of course was preceded by an op-ed you wrote back in April in the Washington Post, Let's Just Say It, The Republicans Are the Problem, has fallen victim to the kind of binary notion that governs our press, where you have this convention of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. In other words, the pro, the con argument, and then this kind of meaningless mush that presupposes in the universe of discourse there's two equal and opposite black and white opinions. And as Thomas was just saying, it was in fact a Tea Party tantrum that threatened the full faith and credit of the United States. However, it was not necessarily reported that way in the mainstream press. And you're not getting, either of you, getting any traction with this book in terms of the Sunday morning talk shows.
That's been an interesting phenomenon. We're going to make our first appearance this Sunday on Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. But the fact is, even after a number of people have pointed out in print and in other places that we haven't been on any of the Sunday shows, Meet the Press, Face the Nation, this week, or even the shows that deal with journalism, like Howie Kurtz's show on CNN, and this has been repeated all over the place, we haven't gotten a call from any of them. And frankly, the fact that they don't have either or both of us on as panelists is no big deal. What's equally interesting is that the topics that we've raised, and that op-ed that you mentioned that was in the Post went absolutely explosively viral. It got more than 5,000 comments on the Post op-ed page within 24 hours of it being posted, which was 2 days before it was in print. We've now had over 250,000 Facebook referrals and over 1.5 million web hits on the piece. This was the subject of discussion all over Washington the Sunday that it appeared and all out throughout the next week. And they didn't even discuss it. None of the shows brought up these issues, and especially the issue of the press repeating false equivalence, saying it's all about reporting both sides of the story, not the, in many cases, what might be five or six sides of a story, but in particular, not focusing on what the truth is, rather than saying two sides are both have to be equal, which means a hit-and-run driver and a hit-and-run victim would be considered equivalent. This is really important stuff. We've gotten tons of emails and had personal conversations with top reporters in Washington who tell us that at least our book has now opened up a conversation in the newsrooms that many editors and even reporters were reluctant to have. But the idea that you'd actually discuss it in this way or even legitimize the idea that one side is more to blame than the other is anathema to an awful lot of these mainstream press outlets, I'm afraid.
And Thomas Mann, I mean, can we extrapolate now on that notion? Because it seems to me that what the press does in political races, particularly in presidential races, is that they level the playing field. And I think Romney's getting a fairly easy path, is he not? And as Thomas was saying earlier, the difference between the compromising and many, say, feckless Democrats who accepted the Supreme Court decision in Bush v. Gore and basically swallowed their indignation compared to how Obama had has swept in with getting the trifecta, the Congress, the Senate, and the House, and he is treated like an illegitimate interloper.
Yeah, I mean, our point is not to say one candidate is being treated gently and the other harshly. We want to get at the more fundamental problem here, which is the press needs to be concerned about the truth of what is said and argued, the evidence, the accuracy. Instead, they're afraid if they do that, and it seems to favor one side or the other, that they'll be accused of partisan bias, and they're right. There are party operatives out there who will jump on them, but the problem then is that the public is misinformed. They're almost demobilized, disarmed. They said, oh, they're all involved in this. There's no difference. There's nothing we can do. Well, there are differences, serious differences, and yet the spin that passes for a reality and then the overwhelming emphasis on the candidates themselves and their personal qualities and the nature of the race and what's said today and what difference does it have on the polls. I mean, all that stuff is almost without any meaning and utility to an electorate that's trying to hold their elected officials accountable. So in its stress for balance and fairness, the press, and let me say it's true of other nonpartisan observers, it's true of many people in the academic world who study these things as well, to shy away from the truth. And I think that point that we made, and not coming from a partisan source, but rather from two people that had spent 40 plus years each working in a very straightforward way to try to approximate the truth, what was going on, has resonated with a large number of people in the country. We didn't expect this kind of reaction at all. It's really quite stunning, and I think, as Norm said earlier, conversations are moving forward. This isn't going to go away. I hope we've started something that will now move ahead on its own momentum, that others will enter the fray, and that we'll try to get some straight, accurate coverage, useful information to voters, and try to pull ourselves out of a very dysfunctional period in American public life.
Well, it seems to me, Norman, what Thomas is saying points to an even broader problem as a society. If we live in a society where the truth is a moving target, that there's no consensus about what's the truth, and if he who spins and counterspins the argument best wins it, and people do their own reality shopping, Christians get their information from Christian television, conservatives from Fox News, liberals from MSNBC, isn't that a very dangerous portent for a complicated and big society like that, like this one is, that there is no consensus?
Exactly so. And, you know, we talk at some length in the book about the demise of the public square. You know, we had for a significant period of time in this country, and it had its flaws for sure, three networks that were the primary source of news for the vast majority of Americans. We shared a common set of facts about the way the world worked, and then we debated, often hammer and tong, solutions to the problems that emerged. We're now in a very different kind of world, one where people cocoon into partisan media sources, but also rely on viral emails and blogs that can repeat things that are blatantly false over and over again. In many cases, they seem reasonable. They get sent from your closest friends and relatives all around, and when you get them, they have a surface credibility to them. And it leads people to believe things that are not necessarily true at all. We've seen that with a lot about climate change. We've seen it with the whole idea that the president is not legitimate because he wasn't born in the United States, something that now up to 40% of self-identified Republicans, and it varies from state to state, sometimes more, still believe. How can you negotiate with somebody who a very substantial share of voters and some members of Congress believe is not a legitimate president? It's a very difficult phenomenon, and of course we also live in a world where the culture's been debased so much that lies are not treated as shameful things. They're treated as wonderful ways to get additional television time or raise more money. And I must say, just watching Mitt Romney appear at a fundraiser with Donald Trump, who continues to spout the nonsense about Barack Obama's birthplace, and giving it a kind of legitimacy and refusing to repudiate it, only reinforces these worst instincts.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Again, I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, who is a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an election eve analyst at CBS News. And also is joining us is Thomas Mann, a noted congressional scholar who writes and speaks widely on American politics and policymaking, including campaigns, elections, campaign finance reform, and the effectiveness of Congress. Together, they've written this brand new book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. So, Thomas, what Norman was just saying sort of strikes me as being perhaps a way to summarize it is that we live in the age of Karl Rove. And I'm curious about the role that Karl Rove is playing. On the one hand, in the last cycle in 2010, he was against some of the Tea Party candidates, particularly the one in Delaware, the one that practiced witchcraft, or at least said she did, or dabbled in it. But recently you had a Tea Party guy knock off a real long-time and highly regarded Senator Lugar in Indiana. I don't know that Rove's fingerprints were on that, but who's driving this agenda to put in these kind of take-no-prisoners Republicans?
Well, listen, the major party officials, the party, Republican Party establishment, has basically decided it's better to have the Tea Partiers within the party than outside, and so they have embraced them and encouraged them. At times, Rove and others have sided with a traditional Republican against a challenge in a primary from a Tea Partier who was seemed especially weak and might be vulnerable in the general election to a Democrat. But basically, Rove has trimmed his positions depending on what will work and what will sell. His instincts are to be critical of the insurgents, but his objective is to win. He's a very able political strategist and operative, and now he's working as head of and really coordinator of a large number of the so-called super PACs, independent spending only political action committees that often, in Rove's case and others, set up an affiliated 501c4 nonprofit organization as a means of preserving the anonymity of some of their large donors who don't want the publicity. They're engaged primarily in an effort to weaken Obama and to enter those critical House and Senate races where they feel they can make a difference. Their objective is first and foremost to have a unified Republican government. That's traditional. That's what party people do. But they have been extremely aggressive in using sort of new means of achieving those objectives. On the one hand, trying to diminish the electorate, particularly in sort of low socioeconomic status neighborhoods where they would presume Democrats would have more support, and in coming up with new ways in a regulated campaign finance system to operate without limits. It is an extremely hardball, permanent war campaign being waged to win, period. As far as what Rove is concerned, what they do afterwards is an issue to be dealt with as to how they deal with the Tea Partiers. But if you really look at the agenda of the party, the budget articulated by Paul Ryan, the Republican chair of the House Budget Committee, and look at Mitt Romney's campaign promises, you realize it
it's really, it calls for a radical change. It's not a deficit reduction plan. We've got all kinds of expert and bipartisan, nonpartisan committees that have indicated what that would take. This is something fundamentally different. It's to cut taxes, not raise revenues, and over time, it's to shrink and eliminate substantial parts of the federal government.
So, Norman Ornstein, is there a psychological component to this? I sense that this sort of take no prisoners, no compromise mentality is driven by some kind of psychological momentum or core. And when you have people like Alan West, the congressman down in Florida, who says that there are, 80 communists in the Democratic Party, and nobody much gets up in arms about it. Michelle Bachmann said pretty much the same thing. Sarah Palin basically says she's an American, and people that don't agree with her are not real Americans. And this division that's happening seems to be driven by some kind of psychological quotient that I can't put my finger on. Yeah. But the passion is such that it makes you feel that, you know, as we know, I don't want to belabor the election, but it is an election year. We're heading into an election where one party is highly motivated, particularly on the right, and the other party is pretty disillusioned on the left.
Well, I think one of the things that's happening is that some of the extreme tactics and comments that we're seeing from especially some of these outside groups, but from bombastic members like Alan West, may be creating a little bit more motivation for the left. And at the same time, some of the policies being pursued may do the same. I was watching some footage of Trent Franks, a Republican House member from Arizona, on the House floor today with this new bill that would basically make it more difficult for people to get abortions, the idea being that you can't choose the sex of a child as a prerequisite. Now, you know, we have all kinds of safeguards in place on this front, and the bill is designed in a way to intimidate women even more. But what Franks was doing was basically going after Asian American women in a way that I think will probably get more of them a little bit more agitated and upset and may convert some voters. But at the same time, I think your general point is right. People who are angry with the status quo, and in this case, more of them are angry with the status quo that identifies Barack Obama as president, tend to be more intense and more involved. And I think that's even more true on the right as a general matter. And right now, if we're looking for the key, I think it may be in the word tribal. I was just reading this wonderful other new book by Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind, and kind of looking at different motivations in the minds of liberals and conservatives and others. And I think what you see is that perhaps at a gut level, Sarah Palin knows how to tap into some of these primal, this is our tribe against their tribe, this is our way of life being challenged, that if you look at how it's being reinforced by emails, by Fox News, which has, you know, just aired a remarkably partisan short documentary on its morning news show, you look at what Rush Limbaugh says, all of that is designed to activate the people in a way that is different than, I think, what we've seen in quite a while.
Well, just in closing, let me give Thomas Mann the last word here and ask you about the psychological underpinning and the extent to which the Republican Party is actually becoming more like a Soviet kind of Stalinist party in its sense that it doesn't want to compromise, it just wants to destroy the other side. And, you know, it feels in many ways that, on the other hand, the Democrats sometimes feel like a victim of a mugging that's running after the assailant saying, oh, by the way, here's my wallet, you know.
Listen, one of the people we quote extensively in the book is a Republican who worked for 30 years on the Republican side of the aisle in Congress, Mike Lofgren, is it, Norm?
Lofgren, yeah.
Lofgren, who who sort of chronicled the change in the Republican Party and the kind of autocratic characteristics it took on. He's apparently now finishing a book which will be out in August, which will document much more of this. Listen, libertarians don't, you know, presumably don't aspire to a big government Stalinist regime. So we need to be careful in the words we throw around and use. But I think it's fair to say that there really are a different set of values that are the center of gravity of each of the political parties, and they're. Norm cited one important piece of work on this. There are dozens of scholarly articles on this pointing out substantial differences, sort of more fundamentalist, more traditionally authoritarian in sentiments. It's not everyone. It's just that they tend to cluster more in the Republican Party. And right now, the key thing is their position. They see themselves as an insurgent outlier. They have identified the enemy, and all is fair in love and war, and this is war. And the ends justify the means, and that allows them to engage in tactics that certainly do not support the image of America as a model democracy. Let me put it that way. We have a lot to explain about our dysfunctional politics, and unless we're prepared to note the differences between the parties, then we're simply looking past the source of many of our difficulties.
Well, I thank you, Thomas Mann, for joining us here today, and Norman Ornstein. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein, who's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an election eve analyst for CBS News. And he is the co-author with Thomas Mann of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. And Thomas Mann's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, where he holds the W. Avril Harriman Chair. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.